listening to the Fantasy Movie League podcast, the free fantasy game for Hollywood. Pick 8 movies for your own fantasy cineplex each week, earn points from real weekend box office results. Compete for free in public leagues or against your friends at fantasymovieleague.com. This is Wednesday, March 9th, 2016, and it's week 2 of the Fantasy Movie League spring season. I'm Pete Johnson, the Fantasy Movie League nerd, and I'm here with Patrick Reardon, the box office guy. And Patrick, big weekend for Zootopia.
You know what I was anticipating? Like in the mid-60s, wouldn't be shocked if it went higher. So 75, it didn't like floor me, but I was surprised it went even that, like a little bit higher than I thought. So good for Zootopia and the people at Disney who like have had enough good fortune lately.
Yeah, they have. I mean, we've talked about the marketing machine they've built here, but in this particular case, the Rotten Tomatoes reviews, everybody seems to love this movie. That's got to be part of it as well.
I think, like, again, the long-range forecast, I think, was, like, 56 or in like somewhere in the mid-50s, you tell me, and then it gets over 70. I think the main reason it's actually a good movie, it seems like people love it across the board. So if you make a good movie, people often will come.
Now, as we'll talk about when we talk about what it looks like for week two, it's acting more like a Pixar movie in terms of its opening weekend than sort of a traditional Disney animated movie if you look over the histories of those kinds of films. Well, I pinpointed a couple of comps for week two for those guys that we'll talk about here in a minute. But it was Best Performer, as you know, and it was part of the Perfect Cinema as well, where Zootopia and Seven Screens of Risen was the Perfect Cinema this week. 349 people played it, but if you played Zootopia at all, you know, it's week one. You're plenty within striking distance, and even if you didn't, there's 12 more weeks to go here.
Oh yeah, like I'm barely in like the top quarter, but I'm only like $9 million off the lead, which isn't bad. And like I had Zootopia as my anchor, and the rest of my lineup, I was hedging Eddie the Eagle and The Revenant, chasing the bonus. It like didn't pay off, but like nobody could be that far out of it. So it's only week one.
Yeah, we've got we had a bump in active users this week. We went up over 15,000 active users for the week. And I don't know if that's people just coming back after maybe not paying attention as much after not doing as well early on in the award season, or if we got a bump. I don't think we did any kind of hardcore marketing efforts with Matthew showing up different places, but we've got more active users. And I noticed that a lot of them, it seems like a lot of folks were worried about their prospects after week one in the chat, or a little bit more so than other weeks.
Again, I've been playing like even longer than like the game's been available. I think I've had a Perfect Cinema maybe 3 or 4 times the entire time. So you're not going to get it every week. It's very difficult to do.
Well, and in fact, here's my nerd stat of the week for you, Patrick.
I always love the nerd stat of the week.
I went back and looked at our award season champion, KM, and found that he only had one Perfect Cinema throughout the entire award season, and it was the Forest lineup that you recommended on this very program.
The one that I recommended and forgot to play myself because I stuck with my Coma lineup that week. But yeah, so slow and steady wins the race. You don't have to get a Perfect Cinema every week. In fact, it's almost impossible. But if you get one here and there, like everybody's in it.
The stat that they had out for the season and awards that showed kind of the what percentage were you of Perfect Cinema. As long as you keep that number high, as long as you're close every week, you keep yourself in the running. You pop one or two Perfect Cinemas in there, you'll find yourself in the top 100, I think.
Again, I'm not worried. Like, you know, everybody's still in the game. It's like when those big swing weeks come, which we know they're on the way.
Now, last week on the interview segment of the program, we had Angry Geek on, and I asked him a question.
He wasn't that angry.
I know, he wasn't that angry. I asked him a question about what really bad movie did he learn a lot from, and it really stuck with him, and he didn't have a good answer. He provided me an answer on the forums earlier today, and I'm guessing you've never heard of this movie.
Try me. You never know.
Okay.
Like, you know about the amount of useless information swimming around in my head.
So it's from 2010. It appears to be a French horror comedy film called Rubber.
Okay. Actually tell you, not only have I heard of it, I haven't seen it, but I am almost positive it's in my Netflix queue because somebody recommended it to me as a weird movie. It's like, I probably have about 50 movies in my queue. Who knows how many of these I actually get to. It's probably down there in the bottom, but I know the poster. I can see it in my Netflix queue now. I've absolutely heard of it, have not seen it.
Well, the poster that I'm looking at on IMDb, it's a tire with like an with the space for the hole in the middle has like kind of an evil eye staring at you.
Yeah. See, even though he hates it, he says it's the worst movie. Now I'm intrigued to like work my way down the queue and maybe move that up a few slots.
Well, let me give you the one-liner for it on IMDb. Are you ready for this? A homicidal car tire.
Yes.
Okay, so stop right there. A homicidal car tire, that gets you right there. You're instantly interested in this, aren't you?
This is probably what drew me to it in the first place. I'm trying to think. Somebody must have recommended it to me, or I was just like scrolling through Netflix options. But I'm like, that just sounds downright bizarre. And like, so maybe it recommended it for me. Like, I don't know what that says about me. But yeah, it's in my queue.
A homicidal car tire discovering it has destructive psionic power sets its sights on a desert town once a mysterious woman becomes its obsession.
Okay, this strikes me. It sounds like Stephen King's Christine, but instead of going with the full-blown car, it's just the tire.
See, it's funny you went to Spielberg like that. When I read that,
King.
I thought,
I'm sorry, did I say Spielberg? I meant King.
Well, I went with The Duel is what I thought of.
Which I have seen Duel, so I can chip in there. Yes, I have just like I'm looking directly at my Netflix queue, and Rubber is definitely in there.
All right. Well, maybe some other folks will add it as well. It'll reach a new audience thanks to our friend Angry Geek.
You know, like Angry Geek and the two of us, we've just kept that alive. Like cult status is not that far off.
Now, here's the other one I wanted to give a shout out to. M37 had a really nice trend article this week. Did you happen to catch that one?
I did take a look at it. I'm happy. Like we've got like new content popping up like almost every day, Monday through Friday. M37 with an excellent article.
I'm a sucker for a good graph, as you know, and he's got a really nice one in this article.
This is right up your alley.
Yes, that visually shows variances of movies over the award season from what their pro box office projections were, the weekly projections. And he found, and I found something similar in an article in the fall season, and so did our friend Ari, that it's those opening weekends are really difficult to find. Usually weeks 2 through 5 are much simpler, much easier, because there's kind of a known pattern to go from, but that opening weekend and after that 5th week can be really difficult.
After like the first week and then comps come into play, you can get a pretty good idea how something's going to perform, but that's what makes the game great. It's that opening weekend. Like you can use stats only so much, but a lot of it, you got to go with your gut to a certain extent.
Well, here's 4 movies that were more than, I think it was 20% below their forecast, and you tell me what they have in common, okay? Because I don't think they do.
I'll try my best.
Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies, 999, Zoolander 2, 13 Hours of Benghazi.
These three, okay. Hold on.
Can't do it, can you?
No, I'm just like thinking like Zoolander, like Benghazi, like same studios, but then Pride, Prejudice,
nope.
Not the same.
Can't find it. Now, here's the 2 he's got on his graph that did greater than 20%.
And I haven't seen any of these, so I can't really say whether or not they're all terrible movies.
Let's play on the other side. Greater than 20%. Daddy's Home and Revenant. There is no way you can find something in common between those new movies.
They were both based on true stories. You can't tell me there hasn't been Daddy's Home. Like, I guarantee you there's been situations where, like, you know, the stepdad tried to come in and, like, compete with the real father. It's very loose, but I'm sure that's happened.
Yeah. All right. I don't know if I'm going to give you that one.
At Daddy's Home, at any point, did anybody, like, cut open a horse and then spend the night in it?
I don't think so.
Then I'm out of ideas.
All right. So shout outs for Angry Geek and M37, but another shout out for our interview subject this week. I got a chance to catch up with Just Plain Awesome to hear about what her Oscar trip was like. So let's take a listen to that. So this week we have our first return guest in Just Plain Awesome, who's fresh off of her visit to the Oscars red carpet. Welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you got a dish here. So what all did you get to do? What was sort of the structure of your trip you got to make? So let's start with that.
Sure. So the main thing was obviously the Oscars event. They paid for transportation, all the flights in, and the hotel there. But the big event was the Oscars, and I know we had talked earlier. I didn't know if I was going to have extra days, but I ended up only being able to be there when they flew me in Saturday, just in LA Sunday, and then I had to go home on Monday for work. So unfortunately, it was a short trip, but yeah, it was the Oscars ceremony, and I don't know. Do you want me to talk a little bit about that day?
Well, let's take this chronologically then. So about what time did you get into LA and get settled? Was there time to do anything fun on that Saturday night, or was that just all a travel day?
No, so that Saturday we got into LA about, I think we got onto the tarmac at noon, but we sat at LAX forever.
Welcome to Southern California.
Yeah, that's right. So we were there for, I think we ended up being there an hour, hour and a half. But anyway, so got in early afternoon. We did a tour of celebrity homes, allegedly celebrity homes.
Never know, right?
I feel like they were probably just showing me houses, and I was going, oh, great, I'm going to take pictures of random houses.
And was that one of those where it's the bus that doesn't have the top to it, so you can see a little better and experience the weather?
Yeah, exactly.
And you already, right, the weather was pretty nice compared to what you're used to there, right?
The weather was really nice, and so that was fantastic. We went to In-N-Out Burger, which is not exciting for you, I'm sure, but living well west, or well east rather, of anywhere they have locations, that was very exciting.
That is exciting for me. I would have been sad if you didn't get that opportunity. Yes, there are people who say that In-N-Out is overrated, but being a Southern California native, I am very biased towards In-N-Out Burger, and despite being a vegetarian, I can still find stuff there. They make a pretty mean grilled cheese, and I highly recommend the fries well done.
No, I love In-N-Out. I'd had it in we did a basketball tournament. It's probably been more than 10 years in Northern California. I want to say we're in the San Francisco area. But anyway, so that was – I definitely had to do that because I love In-N-Out, and they're
okay,
not over.
Okay, so you got that Saturday.
It's insane.
Cool. So you got that Saturday.
Right. So that was Saturday. And then you know how travel is. So we didn't do that much else, mostly a little tour and then sleeping at the hotel.
All right. So Saturday so far, you got a tour of the homes and you got yourself some authentic SoCal cuisine. So that's pretty good
that's
so
right.
far. So then,
so far, so good.
So then what happens on Sunday?
So on Sunday, it's kind of amazing. You have to get there very early. I think our group was 9 a.m. was when we got there. And so obviously the ceremony doesn't start until, the ceremony starts at 5:30, and the celebrities don't even start coming until 3:30, 4.
Right, that's local.
Yeah, and that's all the local times there. So yeah, you have to get there very, very early because they bring you in flights and everything. So we were there for a long time, and they give you, get swag bags. I mean, it's not like the stuff the presenters get that's worth thousands of dollars, but t-shirts and, beauty products, because a lot of it's sponsored by Dove and People and stuff like that, and they do photo booths, and there were aura readers, and there was food, so that was all great. But
okay, so what were the two coolest things in your bag?
There's a t-shirt that was very cool, and there was a nifty, I can't think of the name, but it was a candy bar type thing that was delicious. And I can't remember the name, so clearly it really made an impression on me. But no, it was
good. You mean like something that's not on the market yet is like a test sample thing?
It's possible. I have to admit that I'm not this was not exactly the stuff I'm typically buying. So if it's on the market, it's not something I see regularly.
Okay, so candy and cool t-shirt. And then what was the food like there in and around the venue?
The food, I mean, it's your typical serving mass people food. I mean, they tried hard to make it nice. I'm not trying to rag on them, certainly. But, it was sandwiches and bagels and donuts, which is all great. Like, I enjoyed it thoroughly. But, this wasn't, I think, what they were probably handing off to the celebrities.
Sure. So they always have, whenever they hold the Oscars, they always have this helicopter shot of the area that has the huge red carpet that takes up the whole city block. And you can kind of see there's typically the grandstand, and there's where the press are right up against the railing. So what was your proximity to the red carpet itself?
Sure. So we were, maybe 6 or 7 rows back, but actually at one point at the end, we actually got to walk over the red carpet. So that was, and we were right across from, I'm trying to think of people who would have been on TV, because a lot of the people we were across from were more international, but Guillermo was there, and we were pretty close to Oh, Al Roker. We were relatively across from him to give you
Okay.
kind of an idea of where on the carpet.
Because
But
they set
it's.
up each different outlet has their own little setup spot, their own little piece of real estate along that red carpet. So, all right, so you're across from Al Roker and Guillermo. I like that.
Yeah, kind of in that area. And it's very cool because it's amazing how long it takes to set up. And like starting at about 10, 11 in the morning, there are people doing broadcasts for all of the different countries. So
Sure.
not, I don't think there are a lot of US broadcasts that early, but I know they kept instructing us to cheer in the background for like, Chile and Brazil and a bunch of South American countries that were there early.
Okay. So then it sounds like you had a pretty good vantage point when folks started to arrive and go through the red carpet Q&A kind of stuff.
Yeah, very cool vantage point. They have everybody sit down, so they try and make it so you can see. It only sort of works though, because another cool thing is there are a bunch of crews really close to you. Like I know we had a group from ABC who kept doing. I don't know how the broadcast worked because I didn't. Obviously I didn't watch all the pregame hoopla type thing, but we had several crews who would come in and be photographing from our area or even photographing us. So that was fun. But yeah, we were very close to the celebrities. Some of them make a real effort to like acknowledge the crowds. Sylvester Stallone was really good about that,
Okay.
and Brie Larson, Jennifer Garner were all really fun about that. Matt Damon. Some of them just kind of ignore the crowds, and that's fine too. Like you can see them really well from where you are, so it doesn't matter. And some of them get really caught up in interviews, like Whoopi Goldberg, who, yes, my fantasy movie league
Cohort.
co-champion, yes, cohort was. She was always hard to get a picture of because she was doing interviews. Like everyone wanted to interview Whoopi, so
Did
yeah, it was.
anybody look strikingly different in person than they do either on screen or on TV?
I mean, the only thing is, and understand, I'm coming from Wisconsin, where our main food groups are beer, brats, and cheese.
Okay.
God, these people are tiny. Like that's what
Yeah.
struck me was, I mean, not the men as much. Obviously, I'm talking more about the women. But just how small some of these people are. Because I don't think that always comes across on screen. Just how, I mean, you live in LA, so maybe for you these are normal sized people. But definitely for me, I was struck by just how sort of small a lot of them, certainly the women are.
Sure. No, there's a decent mix of what I'll say normal people, such as myself, and those that kind of look like they constantly need a sandwich. So I'm with you there. Yeah, and that's, they always say that, the camera angles and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, the women in particular tend to be especially thin.
I mean, stunningly so, though, because obviously you see them on TV and you know they're thin. I mean, you just do. But in person, I mean, yeah, you almost want to just hand them a sandwich, Say, here, I'm going to take you to
Yeah.
Wisconsin and explain fried food to you.
You could have taken them to In-N-Out.
I know, yeah, I think they would have absolutely loved that, I'm sure.
So how long did that part of it go on? So it sounds like your group got there at 9, you're sitting around for a while and you got the food, which was how you just put it a minute ago, the way that you feed a lot of people at a
Yeah.
time. So the celebrities start showing up around 3:30 or so, and I think the broadcast started about 5:30 local time. Is that about right?
Right, that all sounds pretty close. In the first like hour, you're getting pretty minor people. I mean, a lot of screenwriters and directors you've never heard of
Right.
type. And then at sort of the last hour, hour and half hour, you just get everyone in a rush, all of, the major category people. Pretty much everyone you've heard of showed up in the last hour.
Who was late? Who was the last sort of notable?
Jennifer Lawrence was late. I don't know what happened there. People, I'm sure they probably knew on TV, but I don't know if she hit traffic. I know the traffic patterns were really weird because of Biden's motorcade. So maybe that was it. But yeah, she came in really late. We were getting ready to go, and they were like, "Oh, good news, Jennifer Lawrence is here."
Cool. So then what happens for you? What was the event like after then? So the celebrities all go by. What was then? There was one more part of the package, wasn't there, that you got to do after
Right,
that?
yes. So then there was a screening over at the El Capitan, which is a theater just right across the street, basically, from the Dolby Theater, which is where they have the Academy Awards. And that was pretty cool. Like I said, we got to actually go down and walk on the carpet after they were gone, so that was cool. And there's a bit of a delay because they have to obviously wait till all the celebrities are in, including Jennifer Lawrence, who was late. So we missed the first, I think we came in for the first of the supporting categories. But there was a lot of free food there, really good food, you know, think fancy hors d'oeuvres type stuff, plus popcorn and the typical stuff you get at a movie theater. And it's sort of a cool experience because I don't do like Oscar parties and things. So it was interesting watching it with a big group of people and seeing, you know, what people were surprised by and what people were excited by. And so it was kind of fun.
And what kind of crowd was that? Was that an industry crowd? Was it all fans or was it a mix?
It was almost entirely people who'd been in the bleachers like me. And that's mostly people who've won contests, it sounds. It's apparently it's really hard to get. There were people there who'd been trying for years, like 10 plus years. But some of those are industry people. I know we had like a couple retired makeup people and some a couple of people who've been seat fillers before. So I don't know if that's an industry position per se, but definitely some sort of lifelong industry people were there.
Okay.
But mostly
it was just, they were showing the telecast just on the main screen there at the El Capitan.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, let me provide a little bit of color there for folks that haven't been down there before. So this section of Hollywood Boulevard between, say, the 101 and where Hollywood and Highland is kind of the historic district of Hollywood, where there's kind of the in the old days, like in the 20s and 30s, when it was still the heyday of the studio system, that's where they would hold all the premieres. And there's like the big, elaborate, highly decorated movie houses are down there, the most famous of which is the Chinese Theater.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the Egyptian Theater down there. You were at the El Capitan. The Pantages is down the street. And all of those big theaters, they seat, like, I've never been inside the El Capitan. I've been inside the Pantages many, many times. And the Pantages seats like 2,500 people, which is somebody our age can't relate to going to see a movie with 2,500 people. But that's what they did back then in the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, and this was much more like, for lack of a better term, a theater, like the theaters you go to when you go to see musicals or if you're less lame than me, what other people see at theaters. But, you know, much more like that than the typical movie theater.
Yeah, so what in order to protect the investment, a lot of those theaters, as you just described, were structured so that they could do live performances in addition to doing the movie house kind of stuff. And I want to say it was maybe 20 years ago, it's been maybe that long, Disney bought the El Capitan and refurbished it. So what you saw is a refurbishment of what that used to look like in the 20s and 30s. The Chinese Theater has had many different owners. The Pantages is owned by the Niederlander Group that does, and it's kind of the home for LA Broadway touring companies. And that whole Hollywood and Highland where the Dolby is, it was originally called the Kodak Theater, but when Kodak ran into financial difficulties, Dolby took over the naming rights of that. Maybe 15 years ago or so, they gutted that whole block and built up the mall that you no doubt saw there. And they kind of built the shopping experience in and around the Chinese Theater and the new Dolby Theater. So what was it like inside the El Capitan? Did you get kind of that old Hollywood feel? Is the work that they did to restore that? Can you see that kind of detail there?
Yeah, it's a nice theater, and it does have that sort of old Hollywood feel. I'm not totally stunned to learn it was owned by Disney. I don't know if I knew that, but it's surrounded by a bunch of Disney-style shops.
Right.
You know, like the Disney shop, the Disney store and all that, and they're Disney characters not within it, but sort of outside and the adjoining stores, I'm guessing. But yeah, it's a very nice theater, and I think they did a good job refurbishing it and tried to keep that sort of the spirit of the old, you know, the old Hollywood.
Yeah, the Pantages is similar. That's what I've got more experience with. It sounds like they did a nice job on the El Capitan there too.
Yeah, although I never saw it before, so I guess I wouldn't know. They could have totally botched it, and I'd be like, yeah, this is great.
So you watched the ceremony, and then was there an after party after that?
There probably was. Not that I was going to, because, you know, I'm an old lady. At 10:30, I've got to go to bed. But, and also it took a long time to get out of there, because, again, I'm told it was really strange this year because of Joe Biden,
mm-hmm.
That made security much more ridiculous. So it took a long time. Like, there were, you know, streets and sidewalks and things closed off. So it took a long time before you could get anywhere to drive anywhere, at least for us. Again, my guess is if I had been one of the Academy Award winners, it wouldn't have been so difficult. But, but yeah, no, it was a lot of fun. And I think some people did go party. I didn't because I'm lame like that. But it was a really fun experience. Well, I'm really glad I got to do it.
And then you went home the next day. And so what would you say is the one highlight of the whole experience for you?
I'm torn. I mean, on the one hand, it's really cool to actually walk on the carpet itself. I mean, you don't get to go all the way up to the Dolby, but it's still cool. But probably the part, again, where you're seeing all the celebrities, you're like 10 feet away, roughly.
Right.
It's pretty cool. And getting to watch all of the interview process and just seeing everybody dressed up in their finest is a lot of fun.
Well, cool. Well, I'm glad you had such a good time. You certainly deserve it for the way that you played during the View contest season. And hopefully we'll get a chance to get you back on the program another time. But thanks for sharing. Yeah. I'm sure everybody's going to be really interested.
Yeah, I'm sure they won't be. I will bore them to tears again. They'll invite me. I'll come anytime you guys invite me.
All right. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Now, selfishly, out of all the things that she got to do, I'm glad she got to scratch the In-N-Out Burger itch out of all those things.
I was excited about that as well. And also the Star Maps tour, or however they do that now, which, again, some of these situations, I think it's a great way to make money. You could take somebody through a nice neighborhood in Bel Air or Beverly Hills and tell somebody, like, oh, like, you know, that's where Dustin Hoffman lives. There's no way to verify it. But I had a friend of mine who actually had a Star Map. And, like, years ago, I used to work in the mailroom of an agency. I would have to deliver packages to, like, some of these places, and sometimes they do get it right.
Oh. You sound like you've given that a lot of thought, like you were going to open your own Star Tours business like
well,
that.
Well, no, it's about 50-50. Like, I could take you to Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn's house right now. I remember delivering packages there. I'm not going to reveal that, but it was right on one of the maps that I saw.
Interesting.
So it is kind of strange. Some of them, like, I'm like, no, I actually know that address, and I know this person definitely does not live there. But some of them, like, okay, they actually got that one right. It's hit or miss, but some of it's right, but there's no way to verify it. Worst case, it's a nice, like, open-air bus tour, like, throughout, like, West L.A. It's not bad.
Yeah, I was about to say, compared to the weather she was getting in Wisconsin, I'm sure she wasn't complaining about that open-air bus part of it.
I don't think she necessarily needs to know whether or not Barbara Streisand actually lives in the mansion they were driving her past. It's much better, like, than Wisconsin, and it was a nice trip.
Well, let's
you
move.
Got to see Guillermo.
Yeah, I know.
Guillermo,
that's a star sighting in and
Roker,
of itself,
like,
right?
Like Brie Larson, Matt Damon, very exciting and all, but I think Guillermo, Al Roker, far more exciting.
Well, let's move on here to talking about the new movies this week. We got four new movies, and I want to talk about Zootopia a little bit. Then we'll talk about some of the other movies we have upcoming on the calendar. We got we got four big movies coming in the next little bit here as part of the spring season. So which one do you want to talk about first here of the newcomers?
I think, well, the newcomer I think that's going to make the most money, and the one I'm struggling with trying to find out because it has a high ceiling and a slightly lower floor than projections, 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Yeah, that one's tough, right? Because it's kind of a sequel, but not really. It depends on how you read into some of the marketing. J.J. Abrams is producing it again.
All the articles I've been reading this week have been describing it as a spiritual sequel to Cloverfield, whatever that means.
Yeah, I don't
think it has
either.
Actually anything to do with it other than the fact that it's cryptic marketing. But like, I'm feeling like a pretty solid buzz here. Like, early reviews have like started hitting, and they've all been overwhelmingly positive. I have it like in the mid 20s. I can see it going higher. I can also see it going lower. So it's kind of a tricky one to forecast.
Yeah, the pricing for this one makes this tough unless you think it's going to get up over 30. So Super 8 did $35.4 million on a similar number of screens, just under 3,400. It's projected to be on about somewhere around 3,200 theaters coming up here over the weekend. The original Cloverfield, its spiritual sibling, cousin, whatever we want to say.
Spiritual sequel seems to be what Paramount is putting out there.
Did $46.1 million. I don't know that I'm feeling it to get above 30. I think it has to get above 30 to be relevant for Fantasy Movie League this week, though.
Like, I was just doing the research for my column a little while ago. It was 46, but that was Martin Luther King weekend. If you just took the 3-day, it was around 40. I don't see it going that high. And I think a lot of it had to do with Cloverfield had probably an A-plus marketing campaign, but for probably a C-plus movie. Right. So I think there's a little, like, people, like, maybe they got fooled once, and they're a little reluctant to try and go, like, go to a movie that they don't know everything about. So I don't think it's going to be that high. But at the same time, the reviews have been good. I think the marketing has been excellent. They're not giving away too much. Like, I have no idea what's going on with John Goodman in that cellar. So I think there's going to be a pretty good buzz around it. But I just don't think for this week, if it goes over 30, you have to, like, give it real consideration. Or if you want to stick with Zootopia, which we'll get to later. But I'm having it right in the mid-20s. But I wouldn't be shocked if it went higher or lower. So it's a tough one.
Yeah, I'm not going to take a chance on it this week. I think, like I said, you got to believe it's going to go over 30, and I don't feel super confident about that one. I think there's some safer plays to be made elsewhere.
I totally agree.
Now, what about the Brothers Grimsby? Did you happen to see I guess it was a publicity stunt, the way that they didn't show a portion of the movie on Jimmy Kimmel?
I've seen he went on Kimmel months ago as Borat, and then they couldn't even show the skit on Kimmel, so they just showed the audience reacting to it.
That is what they did.
And, like, whereas 10 Cloverfield Lane has been going with the cryptic, we don't want to give away too much, Sacha Baron Cohen, who I'm a big fan of, he has been on the publicity trail for months. He has been everywhere, like, trying to pump this thing. But I don't know if it's moving the needle enough to really make the Brothers Grimsby, like, break through. Like, I am not feeling good about its prospects.
Yeah, for Pro Box Office, the long-range forecast for that was $8 million. And when they released their weekly forecast for this earlier today, they bumped it down to $5.5 million.
Ouch. $5.5 million. Oof.
Yeah, that's rough.
That made me wince.
Yeah, so that one, I think, is a big risk as well. Now, the next two, though...
I'm a huge fan of his, but this is, I feel like, even the Dictator and Bruno, they didn't quite reach the heights of Borat, but I still laughed at both of those movies. Like, I laughed more often than I didn't, but I've seen the commercials and, like, some of the other marketing from Grimsby. As much as I want to support Mr. Cohen, like, I'm just not that compelled to, like, just rush out and go see it. So I'm a little worried about that one.
Same. Now, we have a new colleague who likes one of the next movies we can talk about. So Todd Thatcher started writing a new box office estimates column that comes out typically on Tuesday or Wednesday here. And he loves The Young Messiah this week. So he's pegging The Young Messiah to get up to $12.7 million.
Ooh, that is ambitious.
I think the same. So if you look at some of the thing that to me is going to be limiting for it. So first of all, its long range forecast was $7.5 million. When the weeklies came out earlier today, let me look this up again. It was at 6.7. So they dialed that down just a little bit. And to me, the limiting factor there it's got two things going against it. And this is going to be in my column. It's going to come out on Thursday. Number one, it's got some competition in Risen. I think we saw, certainly at the end of the summer season, last season, that faith-based films like this can have a strong following, eerily and very oddly similar to the way that horror films do. But there's already a competitor out there in the market that's got bigger marketing dollars behind it. And the lower theater count here for Young Messiah, it started at the week, Box Office Mojo was saying it would have about 1,600 screens. They revised that today to 1,750. I'm not sure that's enough to get it up over 10 million, though.
I totally agree. This is also in my column, which is going up on Thursday. Risen had, I think, 11 million in change on over 1,000 screens more than Young Messiah is getting. So even, and I think Risen had a much more visible marketing campaign. So even if, like, Young Messiah is comparable, like, quality-wise to Risen, between, like, the lower screen count and, like, you know, not as much marketing, I don't see, like, I'm not as, like, you know, optimistic as our new colleague here about Young Messiah. I could be proven wrong if the faith-based people come out on Sundays, but I have it in that 6 to 8 range. I don't see it going much higher than that.
I think his rationale is in the right direction. I like the fact that he took a chance in just his second column here out on the site. So I certainly salute that stuff. I just don't happen to agree with the way that it concludes.
I like being bold, but it's kind of right between Risen and Miracles from Heaven, another faith-based movie, comes out next week. So it's kind of like in between the two. I'm just not super optimistic about it.
Now, the last new film, though, it is kind of an interesting paradox here, The Perfect Match. It's on fewer theaters, 850.
This one is driving me nuts for my lineup because in order to be a factor, it doesn't have to make much more than like 4 to 5 million.
No,
I just
doesn't.
Don't know if it gets there because there are really like I can't find a comp that's relevant.
No, it's hard to find a comp that's relevant here, especially given the theater count. I found in it's completely different kind of movie, God's Not Dead, 780 theaters in 2014. It did 9.2 million. But the demographic here, I mean, kind of in the wake of the Oscar So White controversy, it's interesting to me that we have a film that was produced by Queen Latifah and has a predominantly African-American cast. Kind of, it would seem to follow the same low screen count model that the Tyler Perry movies are very, very successful with. And as you said, in order to be relevant for Fantasy Movie League, because it's only priced at 44 fantasy dollars, it only has to get around, you know, that 4 million, 4.5 million to really be far and away the choice for best performer.
Like, it's a low risk, high reward strategy. I kind of have, as of right now, like my lineup, I've got Zootopia, and I'm trying to figure out, do I want to stack the deck with The Perfect Match because it doesn't need to make that much? So
right.
That's kind of what I'm struggling with.
That's
right
what
now.
I'm doing, and that's what my model shows, is that that's the right play to go for, is one Zootopia and seven The Perfect Match. Now, if you do happen to like the Last Messiah, you could potentially go with – where is it? You could go with – where's my notes here? You could go with 8 times The Last Messiah, or you could go with Deadpool and 7 screens of The Last Messiah. Or the other movie that I think is in play this week is Deadpool, is in its 5th week. And as M37 noted in his column, not only do the pros have trouble with opening week, it seems about that 5th week that there's, because films vary so much in their behavior in terms of how many theaters they're still in and how many screenings they still have and how many marketing dollars are put towards them, you see pretty wide variability in what happens in that 5th week as well.
I actually like Deadpool a lot this week. I think it's really well priced this week, so I'm giving it real consideration. Deadpool and The Perfect Match is how I'm trying to figure out the rest of my lineup, but I definitely like the Zootopia anchor.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about Zootopia. So I teased at the beginning that it acted a lot more like a Pixar movie in its opening than more traditional Disney Animated Studios opening. So the last big Disney Animated Studios opening was Big Hero 6, which did $56 million. And I think that's where ProBoxOffice.com got their long-range forecast comp for it. Do you happen to know the two Pixar movies that opened in the $70 million range?
Oh, the seven. I know The Incredibles is one.
It is. In 2004, it opened for $70.4 million.
I'm guessing it's got to be Nemo or Up.
It is Nemo, the year before. Go. Now, in the 2nd week, Nemo dropped 33.7%, and The Incredibles dropped only 28.7%.
And again, those are a little different. This is why it's kind of uncharted territory. We've got a big Disney movie opening up in March. Whereas Nemo was summer, Incredibles
right.
was around Thanksgiving.
But this has better reviews, right? And those are more relevant the 2nd week.
I agree. That's why the reviews plus like all the kids being out on spring break, I think that's going to have a fantastic hold. Again, that's why I'm going with Zootopia this week.
Yeah, that's why I like the Zootopia and the Perfect Match play, because it's not coming up. If you just use the ProBoxOffice.com numbers, Zootopia won't come up as a best performer candidate, but I think it has a chance to go above the $48 million that they're projecting it based on some of these comps with these you know, admittedly older films, but there's a lot to like about the 2nd week of Zootopia.
I totally agree.
Now, we've got some other ones coming up here on the calendar. 3 of the 4 we're about to talk about, we've got some long-range comps on. So these are all movies that are anticipated to bring in more than $40 million in their opening weekend in the next few months here as part of the spring season. So the first one is the conclusion to the Divergent series. Allegiant comes out March 18th. Its current long-range forecast is $42
million. Oh, I have to stop you very briefly. Like, I wish it were the conclusion, but this is a situation where they've split the final book into two parts.
They did. I didn't really... You know, and the thing about it is...
I think we're getting another Divergent movie, like, next year, even though Allegiant is... It's part one of the last part.
Now I feel stupid for not realizing that.
I wish you were right. Like, I sat through the first one. I'm like, nope, I'm done. I'm not going to any of the sequels.
With Hunger Games, that last book is long. Is a little bit longer, I think, than the first two. And that's a really good book. Allegiant, honestly, is the weakest of those three novels, in my opinion. The last part of the story gets really weird.
I won't be seeing any of the Divergent movies from now on. Like, one was enough for me. So, like, I'm done on that, but it's a loyal fan base. It's probably going to do similar business to the last one, I would have to think.
You would think. Now, a week after that, March 25th, this is one that might actually lure me to the actual movie house, and that doesn't happen very often, and that's Batman versus Superman, who's got a long-range forecast of $159 million.
This is a movie, like, I desperately want it to be good. And this is going to get you out to the theater. This is a question. Do I make a pilgrimage to the Chinese theater to watch it?
Ooh. So this is Chinese theater worthy for
this
you?
This might be Chinese theater worthy, but again, I'm... As much as I want it to be great, I don't know based on what I've seen so far.
Well, if nothing else, it provides explanation for the destruction porn at the end of the last Superman movie, right? That's kind of what the beginning premise is.
I think Bruce Wayne is actually present during that Metropolis, like, massive destruction that was at the end of Man of Steel, which, again, I love the first two Superman movies. I wanted Man of Steel to be great. I like some of it, but, like, some of it made it really hard to love, so that's why I'm being very cautious around Batman versus Superman. I hope it's good, but I don't know, but it's going to be a big movie, like, any way you look at it.
You think it'll be split over multiple days, like we saw with Star Wars and with Mockingjay?
I would think you would have to. It's going to be so top-heavy. I think it's got to be split up.
Yeah, I agree. Now, on April 15th, live-action and heavily... with digital effects version of The Jungle Book comes out. Long range forecast of $60 million for that one.
Ever since I saw, like, the first footage of Jungle Book, I think it's going to be huge. I think it's going to do really well.
Yeah, the trailer for that is really enticing, isn't it? They've done a really nice job with the cinematography and the way that they've integrated the CGI characters with the live action characters. You know, sometimes that doesn't go particularly well, like some of the footage from the last movie we're going to talk about. Sometimes you don't care about that, but in a movie like this that's really about, you know, it's about a kid living in the jungle and not wanting to change his home, that kind of subtle stuff makes a big difference.
Those animals look pretty photorealistic to me, and Jon Favreau has definitely had his fair share of hits. I think, like, plus that and the Disney marketing machine that we mentioned earlier, I think it's going to be a really big movie.
Elf is annual holiday watching movie at my house. Is it at yours?
Those residual checks from Elf must be very nice. Like, anytime you have that mailbox money, like, I tell everybody, like, make a Christmas movie and you'll be set for life.
Yeah, there you go. Now let's talk about the last one, the kind of the big kahuna of all, coming on May 6th, Captain America Civil War.
I mean,
now,
Captain America, it was big enough. Like, Batman versus Superman originally had that date. Captain America moved there. Batman and Superman were the ones who flinched and moved up to March. So that's also going to be another giant superhero movie.
Now, some of the trailer stuff, the kind of that what appears to be that kind of final big fight, some of that stuff wasn't as photorealistic as what we're talking about with Jungle Book. But I don't think that matters. I think if you just got Marvel superheroes punching each other, that's box office gold.
Again, it's those movies, like, none of them have failed at this point. Like, even though the Avengers sequel was down from the first one, it's still going to be a huge movie. And all buzz so far, I think Robert Downey Jr. had a quote this week that Captain America Civil War is the godfather of superhero movies.
Ooh.
Granted, he's a little bit biased, but the anticipation seems to be through the roof on that one. So, again, another sure thing, guaranteed big movie. I would imagine they're going to split that up over 3 days as well.
Well, the thing about the Marvel Cinematic Universe is just like the comic books, they allow the humanity of the characters to come through, right? Is if you look at like the Batman TV show of the 60s or the Christopher Reeve Superman movies in the 80s, those characters were pretty two-dimensional compared to the kind of stuff that they have Captain America and Iron Man going through. And now to have them disagree on this major issue and literally go to war with each other, that's very different than we've seen in superhero movies before.
It is, but I must take issue. You seem to be like really like, you know, talking very poorly about the acting ability of Mr. Adam West.
No, I didn't mean to. I don't mean to disparage the master
okay,
there.
Thank God. Okay.
No, that went the other way and had a campiness to it that you can't help but like, right? I mean, when I was a kid in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, watching reruns of the Adam West Batman was required after school.
Sometimes you'll stumble upon it on cable, like late at night. Like that show will suck me in every time, and it's the best.
My favorite were the Mr. Freeze ones, where the guy had the console that would make it so that you could walk through the room. They would play with the lighting to make it look like parts of the room were somehow warmer than other parts of the room.
There's everything about those episodes. Like, nothing makes sense, but you just kind of get lost in it. And, like, I'm a huge fan of that Batman 60s series.
Yeah, and there's always something on that utility belt, right?
Gotham was fine. I watched the first season, but, like, you know, it just got to be too much. I will take that original Batman show any day.
And no matter how campy, there was always something on that utility belt that could get him out of, like, when he was in the quicksand cake or, you know, whatever.
Everything you could possibly imagine was in that utility belt. One of my favorite random celebrity sightings of all time was Adam West, like, feeding his parking meter out front, outside of a Mexican restaurant. You can't beat that.
Well, we can't do better than that. That's going to wrap it up for week two of the Fantasy Movie League spring season. Patrick, where can we find you on Twitter?
You can always find me at TheBoxOfficeGuy.
And I'm at NerdGuru. You can, of course, get your Fantasy Movie League gear at FantasyMovieLeagueShop.com. You can find the league itself on Twitter at FML_movies and on Facebook at Fantasy Movie League. Good luck to everybody week two. We'll check in week three.
This has been the Fantasy Movie League podcast. Come join us and play for free in public leagues or against your friends at FantasyMovieLeague.com.